It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. My co-host Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up on Central Time, former food critic Ruth Reichel talks about writing food into fiction and how to fully enjoy what we eat. First, at the state capitol today, lawmakers on the joint Senate and Assembly Committees on Health heard public testimony on the proposed 20-week abortion ban that Governor Walker has indicated he would sign if passed. We heard from a sponsor of that bill when it was first discussed. For a counterpoint, we're joined today by State Senator Nakia Harris-Dodd, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 6th Senate District in Milwaukee. Senator Harris-Dodd, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So as you see it, what are the key elements? What would change in this proposed 20-week abortion ban?
What we will see happen is that women who are facing deeply personal health care issues will be forced to have an abortion, which when I read the medical emergency piece alone, the exception to have either a C-section or be inducing a woman's labor, I see that as very cruel. And it just honestly doesn't make any sense why legislators are acting like doctors and imposing their views on a woman's personal issues and personal decisions that she and her husband should be making.
You know, in a post on your website recently, you wrote that you're opposed to this as a legislator and an individual. Can you talk about your personal story over the last year and why you're worried about this?
Well, just over the last year, my husband and I recently were blessed with a son. He will be turning 8 months soon, so I'm really, really excited, and he's a joy to our family. And I remember when I was pregnant, and we weren't facing any hardships with my pregnancy, but every woman has to go through a certain procedure to determine if their child is healthy or not. And at that time, you can determine if you want to keep the pregnancy or abort the pregnancy. And so, you know, I can only, you know, feel terrible if I knew that at that time, if my husband and I needed to make a critical decision and the only options we had to abort, you know, a pregnancy that could have either took my life, or my child could have been born with, you know, a health defect that we could not determine, you know, how to best care for our child, but we knew the best thing was to abort that pregnancy. I couldn't even imagine having to be induced or either have a C-section. So I'm just blessed that we were able to have, you know, a safe pregnancy where my son is very healthy, I'm healthy. So, you know, it's a blessing to have children. And I think the point is missed, too, that a lot of the families that are faced with issues that we're talking about today, they have children. They are loving families who are actually planning to have more children. But there's a situation that occurs during pregnancy that they cannot control. And so, you know, if this continues to go forward, we're putting women in a really bad situation.
A few weeks ago, we talked to Assembly Representative Jesse Kramer. He's a sponsor of this bill, one of the co-sponsors. He and his colleagues say after 20 weeks, abortions cause pain and suffering for the developing fetus. They feel it horrible, as they describe it. This bill is needed to prevent that kind of suffering. How do you respond to that argument?
My question to them is, you know, where do they get that information from? Because the things that I've read, articles that I've read, and, you know, health professionals I've talked to, this is based on science. What's the best way to go about a pregnancy after 20 weeks, particularly if a woman is facing possibly losing her life? And you're talking about, again, a mother who has other children. Either, you know, that family no longer has a mom in the home, or that reduces the woman's life lifespan. And so, I mean, science has determined that the best way and the safest way and even easiest way for a child to not even, you know, to for this process to happen, it really has to be, you know, where a woman can choose to make the decision that an abortion is the best way and best option for that family, for that child. Science has determined that that's the safest way for a child to, you know, be aborted versus having, you know, any other procedures happen that are against the will of that woman and that family.
We're talking about Wisconsin's proposed ban on abortions after the 20th week of pregnancy. There's a hearing at the state capitol on this today. Our guest is State Senator Nakia Harris-Dodd. Now, one point of controversy here, no exceptions in this legislation for rape or incest. If those were added, would you feel more comfortable with this legislation?
There is nothing that will make me feel comfortable about this legislation. It's really bad, poorly written. It is another opportunity for legislators to make decisions over a woman's life. It's very biased. It's like stepping into a situation where, you know, someone is, you know, facing cancer and they may have to have their breast removed, or, you know, other circumstances may have to occur. You know, this is a personal situation that only the doctor and patient should be able to decide. And so I just know that, you know, this legislature is overstepping their boundaries, and it shouldn't even be before us.
I think supporters of this would say, as opposed to that example of breast cancer treatment, they would see a moral equivalent of a human life involved here in the fetus. They say that's a person. So this is a different procedure, and they're trying to look out for the interests of that moral equivalent of a human life.
My response to that would be that it is the choice of the parents, the family that's involved, and that they should be able to decide what is best for that family. Again, I think we're talking about a lifespan of a mother who already have children, and for that mother's lifespan to be diminished, or they lose their mom in the process, when they know that the best way to go about the situation is to terminate that pregnancy, that should be left up to the family, not for legislators to decide for that family.
Now, last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit struck down Idaho's 20-week abortion ban. They said it's unconstitutional because it's restricting abortions before the point where a fetus is viable outside of the womb, that court argued. Do you expect, if this passes and gets signed by the governor, do you expect similar court challenges here in Wisconsin?
I believe that there will be. I mean, we've seen, you know, other legal court battles based on poor legislation that's been written from this legislature in previous years. And this is just another process of bad legislation that I think will be challenged, and it should be challenged if it passes.
Now, this is on what some people have described as a fast track. Your Republican colleagues want to pass this soon, not waiting for the budget to be passed. Do you expect this to pass the legislature, and how soon do you think that would happen?
Well, there was a public hearing on today, so I'm sure, you know, that there is efforts to get this moved on a fast track very quickly. So I'm sure that there will be, you know, something that'll happen, you know, maybe it'll come before the floor by June 10th. So it's moving pretty fast. I'm not sure when the exec is on this particular bill, but with having a public hearing on today, it can happen within 24 hours that they could, you know, call for an exec on this bill.
Senator Harris-Dodd, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
That was State Senator Nakia Harris-Dodd, Democrat from Milwaukee, looking at Wisconsin's proposed 20-week abortion ban. Food writer Ruth Reichel has made a name for herself with her vivid descriptions of food, family, and what it means to eat well. A former restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times and New York Times, and editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine, she turned to fiction for the first time after that magazine folded. Until then, she was known for her best-selling memoirs centered around food. Reichel is in Madison today for an event at the Wisconsin Book Festival. She's giving a free talk about her first novel called Delicious. That's at 7:30 at Madison Central Library. Veronica Rickert caught up with her late last week.
Ruth, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Well, I've read that you said you wanted to write fiction to kind of find a way out of your depression after Gourmet magazine went under. Why did you think that the combination of fiction and food was the right thing to do the trick?
Well, fiction is, you know, it's always been kind of my drug of choice. When I'm really depressed, what I do is read fiction. And I had the mistaken impression that writing fiction would be kind of like reading it, which it is not at all. And, you know, food is really, I see the world food first. So I think kind of whatever I do, food is a big part of it.
Well, obviously, you've been a writer for a long time. You've got a lot of memoirs under your belt, bestsellers. How was writing fiction different from that for you?
Well, you know, when I started writing, my editor, everyone I knew said, oh, this will be really easy for you because all of your nonfiction reads like fiction. And then my editor went on to say, and you, after all, have been wearing these disguises for a long time, so you've been living fiction, so just put it on the page. What I was not aware of is what a gift it is to the memoirist, to the nonfiction writer, to have your characters already fully formed. And I didn't know how much I needed to know about my characters before I started writing. So I essentially wrote a whole book, realized that what I had been doing was introducing myself to the characters, and that I needed to know that, but probably the audience didn't, threw that out, and then wrote the novel.
Well, Billy is the name of your main character in the novel Delicious, and she has kind of a complicated relationship with cooking, at least, a little bit with food. She's made more alive by food, and it's the center of her self-worth, but it's also the center of a dark secret. How would you describe that relationship?
Well, she is phobic about cooking. She's talented, and, I mean, kind of almost supernaturally talented in her ability to take tastes apart and know what goes into something that she's eaten. And then she becomes very, very phobic about going into the kitchen. And as someone who suffered enormously from phobias, not that particular phobia, but I had a driving phobia, and I really understand that what phobias are is a way of avoiding the real problem. You create a fake problem to avoid dealing with what's really, really bothering you. And that's what she ultimately comes to realize.
Do you think that to a degree, a lot of us have complex relationships with food that we need to sort of heal so that we can get to the point in life where it's just pleasure?
I mean, I actually think that very few of us understand our own appetites, and that it's very liberating when you finally do. We use food for so many things that have nothing to do with hunger. And I feel like, as someone who was a restaurant critic for a long time, the gift of that job is that you come to learn your own appetites and you realize when you've had enough. I mean, there's always another fabulous meal. And, you know, to avoid becoming a 6,000-pound monster, which would be very easy to do as a restaurant critic, you really start understanding when you're eating beyond what you really want to eat and that you're doing it for some other reason, and you stop.
Do you feel like you're at the point now, having had this long and nurtured relationship with food, where it is sort of a simple thing? You understand your appetites, you stop when you're full, and you can just enjoy it.
For the most part, yes. I mean, I love food. I'm very blessed with, I love cooking, and I find cooking extremely therapeutic. And I think I am beyond the point of, you know, mindlessly eating. I mean, I think one of the things about eating is to really train yourself to stop and pay attention to it so you really enjoy it.
Now, how much of the novel Delicious came from your experience at Gourmet magazine, particularly its closing?
Well, when I decided that I was going to write a novel, I knew that I wanted to create a character who was nothing like me, which is why I chose, you know, someone who was 21, who had a sister she was very close to, who was new to New York, all things that are not true about me. But I also knew that I needed to put her in a setting that I did know. And the natural place to put her was at a food magazine. And Delicious is very much like gourmet, and I like to think that had a troubled Billy shown up at gourmet, we would have embraced her as the staff at Delicious does.
And Billy gets her job with this signature gingerbread recipe. It wins the boss over, and there's a recipe for that actual gingerbread at the end of the book. Is this a recipe that's special to you in real life?
No, I mean, that was the one of the hardest parts of writing this book is, you know, it's very easy to imagine and describe a really fabulous food. And so I imagined the most fantastic gingerbread that I could possibly think of and described it, I hope, in very seductive terms. And then my editor said, well, we need to have the recipe for it. And I went, oh, wait a minute. I mean, I'm not sure I can actually make a cake that's that good. And so I made a recipe, and then I took it to somebody who's a professional recipe tester. And then when she was done, I took it to my favorite cook at Gourmet and said, you know, said to each of them, make this better. And so it really is a fabulous gingerbread. It's not like anything I've ever tasted. It's one that uses a lot of fresh spices and a lot of fresh ginger, which is not at all what most gingerbreads are like. And I think between us, we did manage to create a great recipe, but that was hard. That was really hard.
Yeah, it seems like it's got kind of a cult following now. People are talking about ripping it out of the back of the book and wanting to pass it on. It's got cardamom in it and fresh grated ginger. Do you think it's going to have a life beyond Delicious?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. I mean, really good recipes go off to have lives of their own. And I love to think about this cake out there, you know, sort of prancing around in the world. And it's been interesting. On book tour, we've done a lot of lunches and dinners. And so I have had, oh, at least 30 or 40 different versions of this cake made by different chefs. And it's been very interesting because everybody needs to put their own stamp on it. So I've had, you know, fancy French chefs do very fancy French things with it, and, you know, locavore kind of chefs do other things with it. It's been really interesting seeing what people have made of this recipe.
Well, I want to ask you about your online life right now, because you've kind of gotten a name for yourself on Twitter and the way that you write about food there. And it's almost, someone I think called it food haiku or food poetry. And here's one that I pulled up from recently. You wrote, radiant morning, grass emerald, sky sapphire, robins red, lilacs blooming everywhere, hot biscuits, apricot jam, happy to be home. It's beautiful. What appeals to you about immortalizing these tiny moments of life and food?
Well, I mean, I think that for me, you know, one of the messages of Delicious is pay attention to the ordinary. And I've sort of set myself out with Twitter. I love the discipline of the 140 characters, and I feel like I kind of found a new voice in it. But what I'm trying to do is celebrate a moment and make it as visual as possible. I mean, how do you put someone where you are in this very short amount of space? And it's been fun doing it, just sort of like sending off a moment of my day every day.
Yeah, and you said that you find joy in the ordinary, this moment. But also I read that it's something that you have to work at. Do you think that that's sort of your sweet spot for you, looking at food and the moment and the ordinary? And that's what you find most enriching about your life right now?
Well, it is. I mean, the thing is that it is easy to fall into despair. There is so much wrong in the world. There is always a war. There's climate change. I mean, people doing atrocious things to each other in some corner of the world. And I think that for me, the only way to counterbalance that, I mean, you don't want to forget those things. You want to be aware of what's going on in the world and do your best to stop it. And at the same time, it's really important to celebrate what's wonderful. And there is a lot that's wonderful in the world and wonderful about being alive. And, you know, for me, that's how I do it. I mean, other people do it other ways, but I feel like, you know, there is a moment every day when you bite into a peach or smell fresh coffee being made. And they're small things, but they're things that can give you enormous pleasure. And it's important not to forget that.
Ruth, thanks so much for talking today.
It's been my pleasure.
That was food writer Ruth Reichel. Her new novel is called Delicious. She is here in Wisconsin speaking at the Madison Public Library tonight at 7:30. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Last week, several news outlets reported that Governor Scott Walker, who's expected to run for president, said that forced ultrasounds are just a cool thing for women. But critics argue that in context, that's not really what the governor was saying. Here's a clip from his interview on The Dana Show.
We signed a law that requires an ultrasound, which, think about that. The media tried to make that sound like that was a crazy idea. I mean, most people I talk to, whether they're pro-life or not, I find people all the time who get out their iPhone and show me a picture of their grandkids' ultrasound and how excited they are. So that's a lovely thing. I think about my sons are 19 and 20. You know, we still have their first ultrasound picture. It's just a cool thing out there. We just knew if we signed that law, if we provided the information, that more people, if they saw that unborn child, would make a decision to protect and keep the life of that unborn child.
So a shocking statement for a political candidate, or a case of the media taking things out of context. Governor Walker has called out the media for gotcha moments. He's not the first candidate to make that case. Former presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, for example, had both accused the media over the years of playing a game of gotcha. Mike Wagner is with us now to explore the line between gotcha moments as a political excuse or a real phenomenon. He's an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
So let's start with that example. We just played a clip of what do you think about how the media treated his quote there?
Well, I think they certainly took the governor out of context. He was not saying, I support this law because ultrasounds are a cool thing. I think it's the governor's view that if people have an opportunity to look at an ultrasound, they might think differently about what to do with their pregnancy. And that seems to be what's behind his support of the law, and not, you know, how neat it might be to show an ultrasound to a friend, you know, to say, here's my daughter's ultrasound or something like that. You know, what did happen, I don't know that he called it a gotcha moment, and people who work for him called it a gotcha moment, but it really wasn't the media engaged in gotcha as much as it was taking something out of context and kind of driving that narrative. And one of the narratives about Governor Walker is that he's a, you know, extreme social conservative, and so that quote out of context fit the narrative. And oftentimes the news media will run with something that fits the narrative, even if it's not in context.
So there's a few different issues just in that, in what you said there. Let's start with that narrative idea and run with that narrative. Are people in the media often, I guess, lazy? They want to fit things into the story. George W. Bush bumbling, Al Gore stiff, whatever the case may be.
That is something that tends to happen, especially in national politics. It's complicated to tell stories on the presidential campaign trail. A lot of the policy positions candidates have can be very nuanced, and journalists feel, rightly or wrongly, or at least people who sign journalist checks feel, rightly or wrongly, that the public doesn't necessarily want to listen to the policy minutiae, and so oftentimes the result, according to some people who study the media, are that the reporters look for these kinds of narratives. And so a really terrific book called The Press Effect by Kathleen Hall Jamieson and Paul Waldman makes the case that what happens is the media decide early on what you are like as a candidate, and then they look for stories that confirm what you are like. And so when George W. Bush mangles the English language, that fits in with what reporters think the then-governor and then eventually President Bush is like. And so it was a story when he would stumble, and Gore was seen as someone who was intelligent, so if he stumbled over the English language, that wasn't a story. Gore was seen more as someone who stretched the truth. When Gore said something that wasn't true, journalists hopped on that in the 2000 campaign. When Bush said something that wasn't true, it wasn't as much of a story because it didn't fit the narrative. And so part of this is when reporters decide this is who this person is, they look for evidence that confirms that, and then they report that evidence.
Now, keying in on this gotcha idea, one of the most famous examples is Sarah Palin being interviewed by Katie Couric. This is back in 2008. Let's take a listen.
And when it comes to establishing your worldview, I was curious, what newspapers and magazines did you regularly read before you were tapped for this to stay informed and to understand the
I've
world?
Read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically? I'm curious that you...
All of them, any of them that have been in front of me over all these years. I have a vast variety of sources where we get our news to. Alaska isn't a foreign country where it's kind of suggested, it seems like, wow, how could you keep in touch with what the rest of Washington, D.C. may be thinking and doing when you live up there in Alaska? Believe me, Alaska is like a microcosm of America.
So, Katie Kirk pressing Palin on a question. She didn't quite answer. Is this a classic example of gotcha journalism, or was there something substantial here?
I think it was a classic example of a politician claiming gotcha journalism. So Katie Kirk asked, what kinds of things do you read to keep informed? And before you got asked to be a vice presidential candidate, you know, what did you read? And, you know, we might wonder whether Katie Kirk asked that same question of Joe Biden, you know, before he got asked to be vice president in 2008. But it's not a gotcha kind of question where she was necessarily looking to trap Governor Palin. She was just asking what she read. And if Governor Palin said, I read the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, or I listen to, you know, Wisconsin Public Radio, I live stream it from Alaska. She could have said any of those things and it would have been, you know, an answer to the question. And I think, you know, she either blanked or thought that what would happen next was some kind of gotcha question, and so tried to deflect from it. And then, of course, you know, it ended up spinning out of control and becoming a much lengthier story and part of Saturday Night Live's parodies of Governor Palin and so on.
So what would be a classic example of a gotcha type of question that maybe is unfair on the media's part?
Well, you know, whether it's unfair, I think, is for others to judge. But, you know, a classic example happened, I think it was in 1999, when then Governor George W. Bush was running. And a reporter asked him if he could name the leaders in four different countries, kind of hotspots around the world. And Bush knew half of the leader of Taiwan's name and that the new leader of Pakistan was a general, but he couldn't name the other two countries that he was asked about. And so, you know, on the one hand, you might want the person who's running for president to know who these foreign leaders are. On the other hand, knowing trivia doesn't have much to do with being the president. And it's not like he wouldn't be able to learn that information very easily, you know, to make decisions. But it does also, you know, it might say something about his curiosity about international affairs, his knowledge about that kind of thing. And so, you know, some people thought that was unfair. Others thought, you know, this is an exact appropriate kind of thing, you know, to ask a candidate for president.
Talking to Mike Wagner with UW-Madison about politicians, the press, and so-called gotcha moments when candidates maybe get caught off guard by a question. Now, there's this back and forth in politics, presidential race or otherwise, where candidates and their people say what they want to say.
Right.
And people in the media try to get them to say anything but that.
Right.
And is that
right,
where these moments ultimately come from?
That often happens, especially in a situation where the reporter's in a one-on-one situation with the candidate. And so, you know, you can think of Sunday morning talk shows or you know, afternoon radio shows as examples of this, right? Where, you know, Tim Russert was well known for this when he used to host Meet the Press on NBC, where one time when a guy named David Duke, who had been a member of the KKK, was running for the governor of Louisiana and was kind of deflecting things and wasn't answering Russert's questions. And finally, Russert just said, do you know the three biggest manufacturers in your state? You're running for governor. You ought to know this. And Duke couldn't answer it. You know, do you know if I told you 25% of the people in Louisiana are living below the poverty line, you know, would you believe me? And Duke said something like, well, I guess I would believe you, but he didn't know. And so, you know, those are, you know, on the one hand, you know, things that might be difficult for the average person to know. But if you're running for office and saying, I want to lead this state, you might know who the manufacturers are or what percentage of the people are living below the poverty line. And that kind of came, and at least the lore of that interview and others like it are that, you know, Russert asked Duke some questions. Duke deflected, and finally, you know, Russert went for the jugular.
Now, a few questions Governor Walker has encountered and other candidates too. Questions from journalists like, do you believe that President Obama loves his country? Do you believe he's a Christian? In Britain, asked about his views on evolution, I think.
Right.
So all those things aren't necessarily germane to one's running of a country or
right,
a state.
Right.
But are these worthwhile questions in establishing something about the character and the thinking patterns of a candidate?
Yes. So the case for those questions are, it shines a light on what candidates think about things that most people believe are incontrovertible facts, right? Most people believe that President Obama is a Christian. You know, most people believe in evolution. And so asking, do you think these things are true, are, you know, reasonable things to ask to understand how somebody thinks. On the other hand, as you point out, you know, in your question, you know, whether, you know, Governor Walker thinks President Obama is a Christian has very little, if anything, to do with, you know, how he would be president. And, I, you know, on the one hand, it seemed like Governor Walker's pushback was not so much that he, you know, didn't necessarily want to answer the question as he rejected the usefulness of that kind of question to begin with.
And he argued that this isn't what people are talking about. This isn't what they're weighing when they're weighing presidential candidates. So irrelevant. He was
A journalist might say, it's not your job to tell us what we should weigh, and it's not your job to tell the people what they care about. It's your job to say what it is you want to do and answer our questions. And so there's people have arguments on either side of that kind of thing. I think, you know, it's probably the case that the reporter asked that question because the reporter knew that it would make news, and it was, you know, kind of a way to be flashy and didn't really reveal very much about what a President Walker might do.
We're talking to politics and media expert Mike Wagner about media coverage of political candidates and whether the media has too much focus on so-called gotcha moments. And you can join in. Do you think the media plays this gotcha game maybe too much? What do you think is the media's responsibility when it comes to questioning candidates, especially for president? What do you wish the media did differently when it comes to covering these campaigns? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion with UW-Madison professor Mike Wagner about what some politicians call the media's gotcha game, trying to derail a politician with a surprising question, an irrelevant question, some politicians might say. And we want to hear from you, too. Do you see the media doing this in this presidential race, in the last few campaigns as well? Or do politicians reach for this as an excuse for avoiding a controversial topic, a hard question? What responsibility does the media have when it comes to questioning candidates or politicians, trying to get them off of their talking points? What do you want to see from the media when it comes to covering presidential campaigns? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Mike, so far we've been talking mainly about what we would call the mainstream media, or what a lot of people would, the New York Times, the major networks. How about partisan media on either side? These are often sides that want that gotcha moment. They see it as part of their mission to find those. Have they changed the playing field when it comes to this conversation?
Yeah, the kind of ideologically oriented or partisan media, your, you know, kind of Fox News on the right or MSNBC on the left, tend to have interviews when they're interviewing people on the other side that are more combative, that are more uncivil, that are more, as a scholar and a UW-Madison PhD, Diana Mutz, is called, in your face. And so that kind of thing seems to be happening with increasing regularity in the partisan media. And so some questions are gotcha-oriented. Others are the kinds of questions where the asker will frame things in a very stark, there is a right and there is a wrong, and you need to answer this, and the politician might not want to answer it in that way, and they kind of get badgered into either taking a position or continuing to deflect. And then, you know, on these shows, the host is the host and can say, okay, you're not going to answer my question, we're done, you know, cut their mic, or we're stopping the interview, or going to break. And that stuff happens more often on those kind of ideologically oriented networks than your mainstream news media interviews.
And even in a non-in-your-face interview, I guess a politician is always looking at what they say with the eye that, even if that interviewer isn't out to get something out of them, there's a lot of people watching for something that is a gaffe or can be massaged into something controversial.
Right, you know, and it's the politician's audience is not the interviewer. The politician's audience are the voters out there, and the people who, especially those who are undecided or persuadable. And the last thing a politician wants to do is make a mistake that's going to get replayed ad nauseum, or to look foolish. And so if you don't know an answer to a question that maybe you should know the answer to, a nice strategy is to attack the news media. And that happens a lot with, oh, that's a gotcha kind of question, or I don't engage in hypotheticals, and, you know, answers like that are things politicians say when they don't want to answer the question that a reporter is asking. And oftentimes those questions are valuable things that voters ought to know.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Morgan on the line in Lafarge. Morgan, hi.
Hi. I think it's pretty much expected at this point powerful tool over them that doesn't get used, and that would be, you know, a blackout. You know, if a politician is just a habitual changing of topics or not giving straight answers, the worst thing that could happen to them is people just stop listening to them, either intentionally or through the media use of blacking someone out.
Morgan, interesting point. What do you think about that, Mike?
You know, it is something the news media could do. That, you know, reporters or media organizations could say, we keep asking you these questions and you continue not to tell us. And so, you know, there could be a variety of strategies they could employ, right? An outright blackout, as the caller suggests, we're just not going to talk to you anymore. Or, you know, it could be more along the lines of, well, I guess every time we're with you, we're just going to keep asking you that question until you answer it. You know, there could be a variety of strategies the news media could take that if enough news sources did it enough times, that might change the behavior of some politicians. But right now, politicians also have the, you know, the ability to dangle, well, maybe I just won't return your calls when you need me for a story. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful thing that journalists have to contend with when they decide how much do they really want to go after that question. They've asked it three times. They've been deflected three times. Is it really worth risking, you know, the relationship with that source in perpetuity?
Well, and politicians of both parties, I think it's fair to say, have been exploring more and more alternatives to the media, either friendly partisan news services or direct outreach in one form or another online.
Right, just to putting up videos on YouTube, emailing their supporters directly, texting their supporters directly, anything that bypasses the national news media.
Are the big sources less important than they used to be? Used to be, if you weren't in these few papers, these three networks, you weren't out there.
They're still important, and most people who are serious candidates for major offices still know that they have to be in them. But they also now know that those aren't the only games in town. And, you know, more people watch local news and listen to local news than engage in national coverage. And so, you know, politicians might say, well, rather than talk to the National Press Corps, I'll do an interview with one local television station or one local radio station. And so they're still getting their message out, but they're doing it in a different way. And after there's been enough complaining or enough haranguing, they'll do their sit down with the New York Times or with one of the major television networks and things like that.
Talking to Mike Wagner about politicians, press, and the famous gotcha moment. Back to our callers now with Nick in Greenfield. Nick, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. My comment is not so much about the gotcha questions, but I feel like in listening to NPR and WPR every day, that a lot of the reporters act like the world started last week Monday, and they don't do their homework and find out that there was a lot more to ask some of these politicians. For example, here in Wisconsin, the legislature has been, over the last couple of years, slowly and very surreptitiously moving control of different organizations in the government from the people to the governor or the Congress. So they're kind of slipping that away from the people, and the people don't know it. They're like the frog that was boiled real slowly, and he never knew he was boiled until it was too late.
Nick, thanks for the call. Getting to his original point there, interviewers don't bring enough context, he says, don't bring enough homework and background, deep interviewing, I guess. They focus on the superficial and the today.
I think that's a common complaint of the news media, that, yeah, as the caller said, you know, there's often a lack of context in questions or a lack of history, and the reporter's response typically is, well, we don't report the olds, we report the news, and we need to talk about what's new and what happened today. And it might be nice to get some of that context in there, but a radio story or a television story has a definite length, and it has to be done by then. Newspaper stories are relegated to column inches, and so there's a balancing act that reporters have to choose to play between context and the things that are happening that are new, plus the potential consequences of whatever it, you know, is that's happening today. And all of those things, I think, happen at once. And then when you think about the interview shows more broadly, you know, sometimes one thing that frustrates me as a person who watches those shows is that sometimes I think the interviewers are more worried about the next graphic they're going to show and moving on to the next question, where they don't listen to the response and miss their chance to ask follow-up questions, which gives the politician the chance to control the conversation in a way that they probably shouldn't.
So, Mike, a gotcha moment is entertaining. It's
sure.
Dramatic.
Yes.
Is there an appetite for public for that kind of deeper interview, that
ultimately longer form interview. Do people want that?
People seem to like the gotcha more than they like the deeper long form interview, which isn't to say people don't like the deeper long form interview. There is an audience for that. It's just a smaller audience. But the research that's been done on kind of the titillating interviews versus the policy-oriented interviews show that people are just more interested when the fireworks are flying.
And are we going to see a lot of these back and forths between politicians and the press over gotcha moments in campaign 2016?
We sure will.
All right, Mike, as always, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner. He's an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, with us to talk about what many politicians call the media's gotcha game as the presidential race heats up. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. Some breaking news from the world of international soccer today, and I'm really interested to know if you're interested in that news. Sepp Blatter, the big boss at the international soccer organization FIFA, announced he's out. He's going to resign. This is just a few days after his re-election to the post, and in the midst of a massive scandal involving arrests of soccer officials for corruption in the form of bribes, kickbacks. Now, I'll say I've gotten way more into this sport thanks to my kids. I'm a total soccer dad. You know, there's games, practices, tryouts. My daughters are in a massive run of soccer events right now. We've got computer games, console games, magazines, and lots of soccer watching on TV. So what I want to know from you is, do you follow the sport? Do you play it? Do you chauffeur your kids to games? Are you going to be watching the Women's World Cup next week in Canada? And are you following the news about this ongoing soccer scandal? Let me know over at the Central Time Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Is soccer a part of your life?